Hello and welcome to the Beyond Biotech podcast number 91. I'm Jim Cornell and this is the weekly podcast from LeBiotech. Amazingly, 2024 is almost a third of the way through. So what better time to take a look at the current situation surrounding biotech funding? To give us an overview of the venture capital space currently is Stephanie Sirota, Chief Business Officer of RTW Investments. RTW is a global multi-strategy investment firm focused on supporting innovative biotech and biopharma companies in the US, Europe, and China. RTW invests in public and private companies across their entire life cycle, with a focus on those addressing next-generation gene and RNA therapies, rare diseases, targeted oncological, cardiovascular, and neurological disorders, and more. So first, I asked Stephanie for some background on the company.
RTW is a $7 billion full life cycle investment firm focused on the most innovative sectors across biotechnology and medtech. Our business has been around since 2009, so we're in year 15 of our existence. We are one of the largest specialist investors in the space. We have a global presence, so we're headquartered in New York, but we have offices in London and Shanghai. In addition to being full life cycle, so what that means is actually our business started in the public space. We invested in publicly listed companies. It was pretty straightforward, long, short equity. About 8-9 years ago, together with a few other specialist investors, we started investing in late stage privates and pre-IPO rounds, and we built that crossover ecosystem. And the irony is that we were able to do it with not that much capital. You know, maybe there was double digit, you know, $1 billion collectively that really displaced the traditional funders to those late stage privates and to those IPO rounds. So I think as companies and management teams, you know, got smarter around who should be supporting their company as they move into the public arena, it became clear that the specialist investor who had a public business could continue to support those companies. So that was kind of how the crossover ecosystem in biotech evolved, and we were one of the leaders in that. From there, we also, you know, tried our hand at going even earlier, and we started a company. So the first NewCo that we formed today is, you know, one of the largest publicly traded gene therapy companies. It's called Rocket Pharma. We started that in our back conference room with the idea that there were a lot of very interesting assets that were moving through, you know, academic hands that were ready to go, you know, into human clinical trials and needed more capital and someone to kind of drive those programs forward out of academia. So we licensed a bunch of interesting assets from academic centers around the world, and we started, you know, Rocket. So that's kind of our full life cycle. We do everything from start companies to late stage publicly traded, you know, commercial enterprises. In addition to that, we also try to think of ourselves as being supportive investors. And sometimes that means that you need to do more than just be a passive, you know, provider of capital, but to do other things to support companies to get over the hurdles that they're facing. So we also do things like royalty financing. We're doing more and more of royalty financings, synthetic royalties. I can explain what that is. We do licensing agreements. We have done a couple of SPACs. So we try to think of ways that we can improve a company's likelihood of getting their assets in the right space and well capitalized.
What kind of biotech companies and disease areas do you look to fund, or does it vary?
It varies. So, you know, innovation is accelerating, and we decided that the way that we would approach the space. So we have always been very deeply, you know, fundamentally oriented and very science led. So it's incredibly important, you know, to our process, first of all, to be completely sort of familiar and behind the science. That has to make sense. And then, of course, we marry that with more of a traditional, almost Warren Buffett-like framework for evaluating the valuation of a company. But then we also take into consideration the competitive landscape. I would say that our favorite investment is where we identify an asset that we believe is going to have a meaningful transformational effect, not just a short-term momentum-driven, you know, step up, but we're looking for things where we can get, you know, multiples of return because we're identifying value before the rest of the market has identified that. I have been at RTW for 12 years now, and during this last dozen years, we have tripled the number of modalities that can address diseases. So it's not just small molecules and antibodies, but we have gene replacement therapy, we have gene editing, we have antibody drug conjugates, we have protein degraders. There are so many, there's radiopharma. So even within oncology, like there are a number of new ways to approach outside of just small molecules or immuno-oncology, there's bispecifics. So there are so many ways to address diseases. So we definitely follow the advancements in modalities, but then we also, you know, look across disease areas and look across therapeutic areas. So these days we're very excited about, you know, metabolic and obesity and some of the adjacencies like liver diseases. We've been big investors in immunology and inflammatory diseases. We spend a lot of time in oncology. Rare diseases are also bread and butter to us. Cardiovascular, neurology, and psychiatric diseases. So there's, we're covering everything. We have grown our team to have those subspecialists across these therapeutic areas.
What does the evaluation process look like when it comes to working with companies? I mean, do they come to you? Do you go to them?
No, that's a great question. And part of the reason that we do cover so many key areas is that not everything is necessarily investable. For example, there has been a lot of advancement in the brain. And if we spoke 6 years ago, I would have said, well, there's really nothing in Alzheimer's, or there's, you know, there's nothing exciting that we're invested in today. But what's really important is, you know, to have your foot in the door and to look at the research. And so you can track the development and you can see when meaningful things happen, when there is a change, then you're ready to say, like, right, we understand that there's now going to be a sea changer. This is opening up a tremendous opportunity. Now we see a potential pathway for this science project to actually become a meaningful drug to patients. So our process really starts with data collection. We even have a team that supports the research team, and that supporting team is called Omni, short for Omniscient. And, you know, together, like, we probably attend in person and also remotely over 200 medical conferences a year. And that is critically important to our process because we need to have that primary scientific data. So over the years, you know, we've built a library of primary scientific data that is extremely large and we think, you know, rivals, you know, what a Pfizer's library would look like.
How hands-on do you get with the companies that you fund, or does that vary too?
It varies. So in an example of getting comfortable with a disease area and, you know, following the landscape, it depends how mature, you know, those assets are that we're looking at. Are we looking at a disease that is being worked on by two public companies, or is it being worked on by two academic centers? You know, how mature is it? What is their proof of concept? Is it a competitive situation? Is this first in class? We tend to generally stay away from crowded areas. You know, we try to stay away from me too opportunities, and we really look for drugs that we think are going to be blazing and disrupting that current standard of care or bringing a new standard of care about. So it could be anything, and our level of involvement is going to be determined based on the need. If something is already in, you know, a public company and that public company is fine and, you know, has a sophisticated management team, you know, we will for the most part be just a passive investor. And that, I would say, is the majority of our investments. But, you know, one example is a company called Argenx, which is over $20 billion market cap today, one of the leaders in I&I, and they had a breakthrough, this sort of pipeline in a pill for autoimmune disorders. And, you know, we started, it's a Belgian company, and we started investing in Argenx when it was in the $300 million market cap range, and it was trading on the Netherlands Stock Exchange. And one of the conversations that our founder and chief investment officer, Rod Wong, had with their CEO was about dual listing and, you know, doing that so that, you know, they could tap into the capital here in the U.S. They did, and companies had a great run. But that's an example of something that, you know, we have been invested in for a very long time and had some influence and some sort of, you know, I would say meaningful dialogue, not just because of the years of investment, but from the beginning sort of shared, you know, our thoughts on how they could improve. Now, there are examples where we get involved with mid-stage, you know, venture. And obviously in the company creation, we are heavily involved. If we start a company, then we own the majority of it. And, you know, we sort of handpick the leadership team and the managers for that company. But even in an existing company, if we decide to sort of lead a private round, then, you know, we may have one of our analysts who's leading that the work on those investments take a board seat or a board observer role. Generally, we will give up those board seats once a company goes public. So we don't have the restrictions of being an insider, but you know, in some cases we do take that insider.
A lot of companies that you talk to when you go to events, I'm not, maybe it's different for you, but some of the CEOs that you talk to mention funding as being one of the biggest challenges. Is there anything that companies can maybe do to help that? Or, you know, I know that the down market probably affected a lot of things.
That's right. So funding is a huge topic of conversation these days. It was not just the down market that impacted the funding environment. If you go back, the 2 years before that were exceptional, and it was very easy for companies to go to IPO and to get a very rich step up to their last round. And we saw a lot of companies go public pretty early, even earlier than they normally do. So, you know, you had preclinical companies in that public sphere. And, you know, when you have a market downturn, particularly one that lasts as long as this last, you know, 2 year, 10 month bear market that we just went through, the competition for capital is fierce. Generalist investors exit the space, and then you're left with specialists like ourselves who, you know, have to really be intentional about which companies we want to fund. And unfortunately, in that sort of competition for capital, not everyone is going to be able to get sort of the same size check. And I know that we were pretty disciplined and ended up, you know, cutting a number of positions and sort of reconcentrating in our favorite names. So, you know, the environment today is better, but we're still seeing, you know, the lack of capital from the generalist investor. So we know that specialists like us have the burden of doing a lot of the funding. And then, of course, there's funding that comes from strategics. So M&A has been really strong last year, and we expect that trend to continue. And in addition to kind of the strategic capital, which is great because it's permanent, and then the specialist capital that's coming from us, we have been doing more of royalty investing and non-equity, like non-dilutive financing for companies. So there's not just one funding solution that can meet, you know, the entire needs of a company. So we're thinking about ways that we can offer bespoke financing packages to companies.
You mentioned kind of some of the strategies. Are there any maybe undervalued or underrecognized sectors within that, or therapy types that you particularly like to focus on?
Yeah, I mean, actually, even today, even with, you know, the bounce back, so our sector had sort of a low, the, you know, XBI traded down to the low 60s at the end of October, was our most recent trough. And then it, you know, had a really strong comeback and reached 105. It has retraced back down to 90. The sector is meaningfully up from its lows, but there are still a ton of great values out there. So there are still a lot of opportunities that we're finding really great deals. So, I mean, some areas that we're particularly excited about, like outside of traditional sort of oncology, like small molecules and immuno-oncology, you know, we're excited about bispecifics, we're excited about radiopharma. So we're finding good deals in a number of these areas, ADCs and cell therapies. You know, I think the autoimmune space had a really big win with the Prometheus acquisition last year, but there's still a lot of opportunity even in that obesity and metabolic trade, because obviously, you know, Lilly and Novo are the leaders, but we're very excited about, you know, a number of unknown and underappreciated next generation therapies and development. So if you look, you'll find. And in rare disease, there's definitely a lot of, you know, there are a lot of cheap calls out there. You could also argue that the capital markets outside of the U.S. are behind and they're weaker. So, you know, in Europe and in China, there are also some great deals.
You mentioned a couple of the big companies there. I was recently interviewing someone who said that those big companies used to have very big R&D departments and develop a lot of drugs themselves, but now they prefer to acquire companies, smaller companies that are kind of doing it for them, I guess. Is that kind of the way forward, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And that's sort of the beauty of this symbiotic relationship between biotech and, you know, big pharma. Biotech can be nimble and can make really, you know, meaningful advancements. And at some point, the large companies, whether it's big pharma or large biotech, you know, they have the ability to sell a drug and to properly commercialize it and to take those approved therapies and bring them, you know, to global markets, which a biotech company, particularly a small or even a mid-sized biotech company, doesn't always have, you know, the capability of doing it on its own. So I think we're seeing a lot of that. I think that is part of driving this wave, particularly, you know, if you think about, you know, M&A, big pharma revenues are at an all-time high as innovation continues and approved drugs are high quality. And we're seeing a lot of these commercial launches. So with that, you know, capital, you know, it makes sense. And some of the drivers are their need for top line growth, upcoming patent cliffs. And so companies that have approved drugs or maybe soon to be approved drugs, but also one step earlier, companies that are, you know, new IPOs are going to be sort of the next set of targets.
You mentioned M&As earlier. Is there a trend with M&As or is it still on the up?
It has to be because of some of these drivers. It, you know, has to be because of the upcoming patent cliffs and that need for top line growth. So we would expect to see that. And we've had a dozen deals this year already with an average premium of over 100%. And the deals that we have seen this year have been across 5 different therapeutic areas: small molecule oncology, radiopharma, ADCs in oncology, and then in the metabolic space, and then autoimmune and liver. So it's across subsectors, and we think the trend is going to continue.
And what about the IPO market? You mentioned that a little bit earlier. 2023 seemed like it was a little bit quieter. What's the state of the market there?
Yeah, that's right. So we've had 8 IPOs in total already this year versus 11 last year. So we're outpacing, you know, last year by a mile. I will note that, you know, of the IPOs this year, less than half of them are actually trading above their IPO price. So we think that folks are probably going to be a little bit more selective about taking something public until they know they've got sort of a real chance of, you know, continuing to hit some of those milestones. So that's going to be, I think, a determining factor. If, you know, IPOs started strong out of the gate this year, but again, we haven't seen that much of the generalist capital come back in. And if they don't see any sustainable valuation or market cap in these new public companies, they're not going to come back in. So we think things are going to be a lot more sort of intentional.
I know that we talked a little bit about how companies may be struggling to bring money in. And the other thing that's kind of scary is that we're already almost at the end of April, which is very scary. But what are you seeing as maybe some of the major trends and developments so far in the biotech arena in 2024?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a lot of really strong clinical data. So companies are doing well. And that, you know, hopefully then translates into more confidence from other funders and other sources of capital. You know, FDA has also become a bit friendlier. I think we definitely went through a period where in that sort of COVID and immediately post-COVID, where the folks at FDA were really kind of bandwidth constrained because so many resources had gone to COVID. There was significant burnout. A lot of people, you know, left, a lot of drug reviewers, you know, left, less experienced drug reviewers stepped into their former manager shoes. And there was a very sort of conservative bent for that period following FDA. And now, particularly with someone like Peter Marks, who's a real champion of gene therapies and genetic medicines, you know, we're seeing some approvals and FDA is friendlier. So, you know, hopefully with a wave of positive clinical data from biotech companies, and then also, you know, a stable or, you know, hopefully a lower interest rate environment, all that capital is going to come crashing back.
And then you have elections in the U.S. this year, so that might change everything again.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. So, I mean, look, there's still macro uncertainty, which is a potential headwind. The election, of course, is, you know, a headwind even for sentiment, because I think there's capital that is going to want to stay sidelined until there's certainty around who is in the office. But at least we kind of know what we're dealing with right now. With the IRA, we know sort of what drugs are going to go through negotiations. You know, hopefully things will change for the better in the next election. You know, as we try to be creative in our thinking around supporting companies, it gives us just ammunition to propose different funding strategies to companies. And so that's why we've been doing, for example, royalties or synthetic royalties, particularly for companies that are launching new drugs.
Could you explain a bit about the royalties market?
You know, historically, you know, you have either an academic asset that has been developed. And if you look at the sort of royalty landscape, there are companies that have drugs that, you know, someone owns a piece of that revenue stream. And that last sort of 5 years, you know, you've seen Royalty Pharma is kind of the dominant player in that space. So there will be a competitive bid around a commercial product, and then financiers will compete on, you know, paying for a slice of that royalty stream. Generally, they're looking for an existing commercial product that the revenues are known, and you don't have to spend a lot of time figuring out, you know, or predicting what that commercial is going to look like. You know what the peak sales are, and then there's a competition around cost of capital, and, you know, whoever can deliver the lowest cost of capital will win that mandate. We're looking at situations where we can, for example, go earlier in that process. So let's say a company, you know, has their first drug just gets approved. Someone has to predict how much revenue that drug is going to achieve, like what their peak sales are going to be. And there will obviously be a Wall Street consensus around this. But, you know, we have a team, and we've been doing this since day one, I mean, for the last 15 years, working on commercial forecasting. So we look at every drug that launches every year and try to assess what we think that commercial forecast is going to look like. So we analyze that in-house. And now we realize that actually not a lot of people are doing this. And so, you know, we can approach a company and then basically offer them a deal to give them money in exchange for a percentage of those revenues. And so these are true sales. So, you know, we're buying, call it 5% of the revenue stream of a particular drug for its patent life. And this is non-dilutive. So in some way, it has that difference from raising equity. It's a lower cost of capital than equity, but then it's not as burdensome to a company's balance sheet like debt would be.
You mentioned how you have offices in New York and London and in China. Are there differences regionally between companies in the biotech market?
Yeah, there are. I mean, the biggest sort of difference actually comes down to capital. So Europe and UK the ecosystem is quite fragmented. I mean, you have a lot of European VCs, but you don't have that public capital market ecosystem like you do here in the US. So companies tend to make their way to the US and end up listing, you know, on the NASDAQ, or, you know, oftentimes are sold. And you'll see strategic sales tend to happen a lot earlier when they're coming from the UK and Europe than here in the US. China, you know, has had a real struggle. Last couple of years have been tough, but, you know, they've had, you know, an even tougher time with their capital markets the last few years. So there are opportunities. We saw, you know, 6-7 years ago, we saw a lot of, you know, Chinese VCs coming to the US and acquiring assets and paying up for those assets and starting a number of Chinese oncology companies. You know, it was all about importing innovation to try and catch up with the West. They've done that to an extent, but, you know, I think the capital markets have dried up materially. So now, you know, it's sort of flipped. If they do the work, you know, they have to think about how to export some of that innovation.
Is there anything that you wanted to talk about that we haven't?
I think I would just want to express that this is one of those incredible moments where, you know, I think it hasn't caught on to the broader sort of pool of investors that there's incredible innovation that's happening in the biotech space, and it's still relatively underappreciated. And with a better macro situation and when more capital starts pouring in, you won't be able to find the deals that you're finding today. And one other area I would also just point out that we didn't talk about, but I think is important, is when the GLP-1s like hit the market, everyone said, well, this is going to kill med tech. The devices like are not going to be needed because now people are going to be living longer. And actually, you know, our thesis is that the opposite is true. And we just saw an acquisition by Johnson & Johnson last week of a company called Shockwave, $13 billion all cash acquisition. You know, Johnson & Johnson has a large market share for treating, you know, cardiovascular disease with medical devices. They had, you know, a couple of other, you know, previous acquisitions in the space. And now with Shockwave, they can address coronary artery disease, peripheral artery disease. But this is important because we think that actually the GLP-1s are going to lead to higher utilization rates of devices. We're seeing that, you know, old age is a corollary to usage for med devices, whether it's for cardiovascular or you know, joint, hip or knee replacements. So we think that's a bullish thesis for devices as well.
So a really good and thorough overview of the current situation surrounding financing in the biotech industry there. Don't forget to check out the latest news and articles at labiotech.eu. And I hope wherever in the world you are, you have a great week ahead. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time for another Beyond Biotech.